This Sunday service is part of the summer series in which spirituality is considered from different viewpoints. This morning, the topic of spirituality and skepticism will be presented by members of the Atheist and Agnostic Circle from this church. As individuals, we represent many different viewpoints, including atheism, agnosticism, freethinking, non-believing, humanism, doubting, naturalism, and more. But this morning, we shall let the term skeptic stand in for all of them. I realize for some people the term skeptic, atheist, or agnostic conjures up an image of negativity. In fact, we have a very positive view and affirm life as it really is. It is entirely possible that the majority of you in the congregation would count yourself as skeptics. In his book, Skeptics and True Believers, the author and columnist for the Boston Globe, Chet Ramo, compares them this way.
Skeptics are children of the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment. They trust the ability of the human mind to make sense of the world. They accept the evolving nature of truth and are willing to live with a measure of uncertainty. Their world is colored in shades of gray. Since they hold their truths tentatively, skeptics are tolerant of cultural and religious diversity. True believers are less confident that humans can sort things out for themselves. They look for help from the outside, from God, spirits, or extraterrestrials. Their world is black and white. They seek simple and certain truths provided by a source that is more reliable than the human mind. They are repulsed by diversity, comforted by dogma, and respectful of authority.
It is my guess that based on that, most of you in here would define yourself as skeptics rather than as true believers. We're going to begin with some personal statements by three members of our group, Erica Skurr, Bob Wilhelm, and Rick Booth.
I believe truth is subjective. My truth is based on my experience of the world, nature, society, and science. Your truth can be different from my truth. The same is true of reality. I believe in the Big Bang. I believe that early giant stars exploded, scattering their dust of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen atoms into space to condense into galaxies, stars, and planets. This is the stuff the universe is made of, the stardust I am made of. I am a dust mote in a vast space which is indifferent to my existence. I believe I can be influenced and changed by my experience of the universe, the world, and other people. I have a sense of morality. I know when I have done something wrong, something that violates my personal moral code, harms another. I believe it is always right, moral, to take responsibility for my own actions. Others are not responsible for my mistakes or misfortunes. My moral sense obliges me to reach out to others in my community, to celebrate common values, to provide personal support, and to show social responsibility. Human suffering is not the result of wrongdoing. Suffering results from a universe exposing us to things we cannot control: earthquakes, hurricanes, floods, fires, and accidents, which can change our lives in an instant. How we assimilate these crises into our lives determines how we suffer. Suffering can be self-inflicted. I can decide to dwell on and grieve an event, a loss over a long period. Or I can weave the loss into the tapestry of my life, work to accept my new condition, and continue to grow. In this sense, suffering is transformative, a source of human development. I believe I exist only because DNA exists as a life-giving molecule. There is no meaning or purpose to my existence. I have no predetermined role to play in the world. I am a responsible person with an interest in life. In pursuit of that interest, I set goals and try to meet them. To a great extent, I have achieved my goals and lived my dreams. I have no regrets for dreams deferred. If my life ended today, I would consider it well lived. I have no fear of death. I had no awareness or experience of the world before I was born, and I don't expect to have any after I die. Death is the last part of life. I have no expectation of an afterlife, except that my dust or ashes will once again become part of the planet and the universe in which life forms will be regenerated.
Of creeds and codes. Perhaps you share some of my experience, maybe a little, maybe a lot. I grew up in a rather devout Christian family and spent the first 30 years of my life meeting my family's religious expectations, but not my own. I spent the next 30 years as a Unitarian, satisfying more of my own religious expectations, but still vaguely dissatisfied. I've spent a lifetime listening to family, clergy, political leaders, and even scientists talk about faith, religion, and God. But the truth seems clear to me now. Not one single person knows or has ever known anything about God. This, too, is a position of faith, since I can't know it for a fact. It just seems the simplest and most accurate explanation for what we can observe about religion, an application of Occam's razor. People who claim to know something about God are most likely either charlatans or suffering delusions. Harsh words, perhaps. But in all likelihood, anything you or I have ever been told about God has been thought up by someone who knew no more about the subject than anyone else. That is, nothing. Some have no doubt thought more deeply about God than others. Some may have studied more carefully the thoughts of others. And surely some ideas are more plausible than others. None of this, however, should be confused with knowledge. Though I'm close to being one, I don't call myself an atheist, because I don't know about the absence of God any more than anyone knows about the existence of God. I'm closer to an agnostic, but still may not qualify, since agnostics are usually described as believing not only that it is not known, but not knowable whether there is a deity. How, I wonder, can one know something is not knowable? Many try to slip through the semantic gate by speaking of belief or faith rather than knowledge. I choose simply to define myself as a skeptic. Many of us frequently find ourselves in the uncomfortable position of listening to professions of faith by friends and family who assume, or at least hope, that we share similar views. Usually they're well-meaning, perhaps attempting to console others in the face of a death or other difficult circumstances. "She's gone to be with her father and mother and sister," they said when my mother died. Although they seem quite convinced of such a scenario, they often seem to want some confirmation that we agree. "Isn't that right?" they ask, or perhaps simply, "you know." We consider it disrespectful or confrontational to express disagreement or skepticism. Unfortunately, our silence, or worse, our feigned acquiescence, does nothing to set the record straight and only prolongs this uncomfortable and imbalanced relationship. Mythology plays a useful role in helping us to understand our world, but only if we acknowledge that it is mythology. I've grown equally skeptical of the language that many of my Unitarian friends use about spirituality. The spiritual means nothing to me. I can be in awe of the universe, of life, and the natural world without finding anything spiritual about it. I admit to plenty of mystery, but to me that is simply what we don't yet know or understand. I can live with such imperfect knowledge and embrace humankind's ongoing and faltering attempts to broaden our understanding through science, through the study of our shared human experience, but not through faith or spirituality.
I'm about to show some videos from something called the Mandelbrot set, a mathematical structure that self-replicates internally. You see a lot of bodies that look like the original. You're seeing it there. This is the iconic fractal of our age. It was discovered in 1980. Pretty big surprise. It comes from a formula that's no more complex than E equals mc squared. In fact, it could be phrased E equals m plus e squared. The more you work with digital systems, the more you wonder with discoveries like this whether or not there's a layer of the universe that depends on fractals like these, as well as the laws of physics to generate the world we're in. It's a pretty good looking world too. Now we're heading down one of the spirals. Having been in video games off and on for the last 30 years, I do know with the discoveries like Mandelbrot said that if I had a God-powered computer, I sure would use it as part of my design mechanism for creating a beautiful world for people to live in. So I suspect that it's in there somewhere. That variance on it, variance on this, perhaps other fractals we haven't discovered yet, may have something to do with it. I'm actually one of the sort of new age proponents of the idea that there may be a digital layer running a lot of the universe. We're about to go in and find my favorite nine-legged octopus here. There's a valley of seahorses elsewhere, pretty famously. Now we're looking for one of my favorite animals, a turtle. I love turtles. There he is. There's a million of them there. I've never been a great believer that randomness is truly random at the basis of quantum mechanics. Einstein famously said that he didn't believe God played at dice. But it's things like fractals, this, things that have been discovered in cellular automata that, for instance, the mathematician Stephen Wolfram has written about and talked about recently, that give the impression that maybe the randomness in our world isn't so random. It may be fractals that we just don't understand yet. I've seen way more coincidence in my life that I can account for by randomness, so I'm always on the lookout for possible explanations as to how our universe may work. By the way, here's something that looks like the Christian cross down in there, too. There's a lot of surprises in what you can find in the Mandelbrot set when you explore. It's so vast that anyone diving in for just a minute or two will find something that's never been seen before by any human eyes. One of the things I enjoy about being a Unitarian and coming to a Unitarian church that actually has an atheist and agnostic group is that you get great pushback there, especially if you got a little bit of theistic belief, which is just fine. I consider myself actually a low-grade theist in the sense that I sense an awful lot of higher order. It's just not diagnosed well by science yet. I mean, I really think it's there. I haven't found God yet, but I'm looking.
You may want to hold some of those images in your mind as we now come to the point in our service where we enter silent contemplation. Immerse yourself in silence and contemplate this pale, blue, tiny world spinning its way through the vast emptiness of space. Rejoice that we are present here and now, and reflect on those who have left us and on those yet to join this wondrous journey.
Divine Image by Virgil Thompson, which Edgell's about to sing, is a setting of a poem by William Blake from the mid-18th century. In it, Blake asserts that that which people define as God is really something innate in all of us. In fact, it's what makes us human, the qualities of mercy, pity, peace, and love. When we were discussing the meaning of spirituality, it seems like everyone had a different idea about what that meant. There were some who dismissed it outright, saying that it had no useful meaning that we could use for discussion. And when we looked it up in the dictionary, we found numerous definitions, most of which referred to spirits, non-corporal, or other than material, or outside of nature. We know that this is not what everyone means when they use the word spirituality, but this just makes using the word more confusing. So how does the skeptic view spirituality? Let us begin with a discussion by David Eller in his book, Natural Atheism, read by Carol Wilhelm.
This talk of spiritual and spirituality perpetuates a profound mistake and constitutes a profound betrayal, perhaps the most profound that humans have ever committed against themselves. The mistake is the prejudice or belief or faith that life and its finer aspects and our ability to appreciate those aspects are not natural, but must be supernatural. That beauty, awe, wonder, and love are not things of this world. No, they must belong to a better world, a higher world, and they are only revealed to us for a brief time. These finer, more powerful aspects of life are seen as separate from us, other than us, better than us, outside of us. Surely we, weak, puny material beings, could not be capable of them on our own. But the things that we call spiritual are precisely of this world. They are natural and they are social. They are not other life, but simply more life. They are not other than human. They are more human. They are the best of human. The spiritual is experienced as getting extra life from somewhere outside of ourselves. In reality, it is discovering deeper or better levels inside of ourselves. It is encountering humanness at its fullest. Thus, by rejecting spirit and spiritual, we reclaim the wholeness of human experience and human being.
And so we say that those experiences that someone may describe as spiritual are human experiences, nothing more. They are things that come to you through your senses and your mind. So let us describe specifically what we are talking about. First of all, we want to talk about the sense of awe, wonder, and humility in confronting all aspects of life and the universe. This is that experience that for some sends shivers up and down the spine and the feeling of smallness in the face of it all. And more than anything, that involves experiencing the universe as it is. Carrie Antimus is going to read from the book Reason and Reverence by William R. Murray. Reverend Murray served as president and academic dean of Meadville Theological Seminary in Chicago, has been a UU minister in Maryland and college professor and chaplain.
For me, the unimaginable vastness of the universe and the incredible complexity of life evoke awe and reverence greater than anything I experienced as a theist. I am struck with wonder and amazement at the fact that there are some 100 billion galaxies in the universe, each with about 100 billion stars, more than all the grains of sand on all the beaches of the world, according to Carl Sagan, and at the fact that the universe is about 15 billion years old. I am filled with reverence and astonishment to know that there are some 30 million different species in the world and that all life evolved over billions of years from one-celled organisms and that our human species has been evolving for millions of years from a common ancestor we share with other primates. I am overcome with amazement at the thought that my body consists of 10 trillion cells and that my brain contains about 100 billion neurons and 100 trillion synapses. I feel wonder and amazement at nature's majesty, beauty, complexity, and power. I feel joy and comfort among its trees or by its water, and refreshed and rejuvenated from working in its soil or walking in its woods. I feel reverence when I ponder the incomprehensible vastness of the universe and the equally mind-boggling smallness of the submicroscopic world. That the universe is, to quote the title of a book by physicist Freeman Dyson, infinite in all directions, is beyond my ability to imagine.
Lines Composed a Few Miles Above Tintern Abbey by William Wordsworth. Therefore am I still a lover of the meadows and the woods and mountains, and of all that we behold from this green earth. Of all the mighty world of eye and ear, both what they half create and what perceive. Well pleased to recognize in nature and the language of the sense, the anchor of my purest thoughts, the nurse, the guide, the guardian of my heart and soul, of all my moral being.
There we go. Several years ago, I led a number of discussion groups here that examined our seven principles and how to live them every day. In these groups, we deconstructed each principle and then brainstormed the many possible meanings of each word and phrase and what they called for us to do in daily life. From this comes an understanding of our fourth principle. A free and responsible search for truth and meaning calls for the courage to ask questions, to try something new, to explore. Following the scientific method of testing multiple hypotheses, refining our questions and accepting that any conclusion is tentative. Recognizing that for every complex human situation, there will likely be more than one right answer. Recognizing, too, that ideology can never trump reality, no matter how fervently we wish it to be so. Understanding that knowledge is always incomplete and open-ended. When we think we have the answer, it is simply the call to keep on looking. It is the freedom to fail, to make mistakes, and to learn from them, and the strength to admit when we are wrong. And always, this principle calls for us to support others in their explorations.
We are often asked, how do you find meaning and purpose in your life without spirits and gods? And we respond that meaning must be derived from human experience, and there is no authority to tell you what your purpose in life should be, other than you yourself. David Crone is going to read a passage from Robert G. Ingersoll, who shares with us his personal discovery of this freedom. Ingersoll was a Peoria, Illinois lawyer who became a famous orator in the period after the Civil War, when oratory was a form of popular entertainment. Although he spoke on many subjects, he is remembered for his eloquent advocacy of free thought, humanism, and agnosticism.
When I became convinced that the universe is natural, that all the ghosts and gods are myths, there entered into my brain, into my soul, into every drop of my blood, the sense, the feeling, the joy of freedom. The walls of my prison crumbled and fell. The dungeon was flooded with light, and all the bolts and bars and manacles became dust. There was for me no master in all the wide world, not even in infinite space. I was free, free to think, to express my thoughts, free to live to my own ideal, free to live for myself and those I loved, free to use all my faculties, all my senses, free to spread imagination's wings, free to investigate, to guess, to dream and hope, free to judge and determine for myself, free to reject all ignorant and cruel creeds, free from the fear of eternal pain, free from the winged monsters of the night, free from devils, ghosts, and gods. For the first time, I was free. There were no prohibited places in all the realms of thought, no air, no space, where fancy could not spread her painted wings. No chains for my limbs, no lashes for my back, no fires for my flesh, no master's frown or threat, no following another's steps, no need to vow or cringe or crawl or utter lying words. I was free. I stood erect and fearlessly, joyously faced all worlds.
I grew up in a rather religious household. My father was a Protestant minister, although a rather liberal one. For my parents, the question of meaning and finding your purpose in life was reasonably straightforward. It had to do with your relationship to the life and teachings of Jesus. And they were firmly embedded in the old mythology. What do I mean, the old mythology? For an explanation, I'm going to ask Bob Wilhelm to read a passage from Climbing Brandon, a book by the author Chet Ramo.
Our ancestors, perhaps naturally, believed themselves to live at the center of space, coevally with time. All the world's a stage, wrote Shakespeare. And he meant it quite literally, a stage for the drama of human affairs. Creation myths from around the world assume that the cosmos was created for us, that it is centered on us, and that time has no meaning other than as a frame for human history. Our discovery of cosmic space and time, a universe of galaxies and geologic eons that makes no reference to human history, must be counted a triumph of human pluck and cunning. After all, who among us would not like to live at the center of the world? Surely nothing can be more flattering to our sense of importance than to imagine that we are the measure of all things. To forego the cozy, human-centered cosmic egg of our ancestors requires courage and a willingness to contrive our own meaning in a universe that is vast beyond imagining. In making the journey into cosmic space and time, we surrender certainty for curiosity, simplicity for complexity, comfort for adventure.
In fact, this last century has been what you might call a game changer. Too many things have changed too much to be stuck in the old mythology any longer. That is, that humans are the center of both time and space. Not only are humans not the center of the universe, our existence is but an eye blink in its history. In 1920, the universe was thought to be the extent of the Milky Way. We are discovering that the universe is large beyond our imagining. The more we learn about the genetic makeup of all life, the less unique we humans are to the rest of life. And so on. There are countless things that require our letting go of the old stories. And so today we face a new task. Who are we? What is the meaning of our lives? Here we are, these strange primates with a large brain on a small out-of-the-way planet. Until recently, we had no understanding of the incredible expanse of time. Ever so gradually, ever so slowly, ever so minutely, over centuries of time, we are peeling back the veil of ignorance. Here we are, just getting the slightest glimpse of how the universe is assembled. Our successes are followed by just as many failures. But over time, there are small incremental increases in our understanding of who we are. Minuscule understandings about our planet. So this is who we are. We are the explorers. We are the searchers, not just in scientific and medical ventures, but in art, in caring, in raising families, in communities and international relations, in care for the planet, in all areas of human endeavor, but ever so slowly, ever so gradual. We are upset with ourselves over the mess we've made of so many things. But out of those failures, we learn some small thing. We are the explorers. We are the searchers. That is the meaning of our lives. We must not close our eyes and ears, afraid to venture into tomorrow. But there is one thing that we must do. Learn. Learn. Learn.
Before we conclude, I'd like to extend an invitation to anyone who is interested to join us at the Atheist and Agnostic Circle. We meet every fourth Tuesday of the month in room 8 at 7 p.m. We'll be meeting this Tuesday. You are free to attend. The conversations are open to all, and we would welcome you if you would come.